I love graduate school.
Well, before we get to that period, I want just a little bit more about your undergraduate career. Your degree was then in 1931 in biology. It sounds like you almost had enough to have a chemistry degree.
I had enough to have a chemistry degree as well.
Did you do any research as an undergraduate?
As an undergraduate in the organic course, during the second semester, I was excused from doing the regular experiments and helped one of the instructors prepare a couple of things that he wanted as starting material for his own research. This was not research. They were making special compounds that he wanted. And that was the only real experience I had. But the fun of it was that I could use a lot of his apparatus and not just the apparatus that was generally available. So I learned more about good quality distillation apparatus. I learned a little more about glass blowing and a little more about how to do more accurate melting points than the kind of primitive stuff that was set up in the teaching lab. That was the main virtue of it. But I did not do any other kind of research in my undergraduate year.
I think you've also commented that during this time with McGregor and his really interesting you in biology, but you're also your interest in evolution, which in some respects shows up through all of your work
later on. Very much later on. Well, the interest in evolution was very exciting as an intellectual thing. What one could do about it in terms of trying to understand mechanisms of evolution clearly would have to come through genetics. And I took all the advanced genetics courses during my graduate career and almost went into the field, but realized that genetics was not ready for the kind of chemistry that I wanted to do. It was, in effect, years, 5, 8, 10 years early in terms of the real beginnings of the biochemical studies of the genetic material and the relationships of the genetic material. All of that came very much later. And I was very much attracted to Selig Hecht, who was a member of the zoology department, but at the same time was doing what was called general physiology, what today we call biophysical chemistry. And this I found intellectually very exciting.
The other aspect of this is, as you've indicated through Nelson, that organic chemistry is a way to approach the secrets of biology. And that thinking, to me at least, seems rather unusual for that time period. That the key to biology was really a chemical understanding. Maybe I'm wrong in that, but that was, and it was Nelson who gave you that feeling.
Well, Nelson gave me that feeling first, but there was also a kind of literature that was around at that time in the biological world more than the chemical world. And this was one of the reasons why I did not want to take a degree in chemistry at that time, because 99 out of 100 people who took their degrees ended up in industry. And I had no real interest in going into industrial chemistry, including many of Nelson's own students who, while they worked on an enzyme or a biological problem, still ended up in industry afterwards. The impetus and the interest came largely from people like Jacques Loeb and his books, Mechanistic View of Life, his book on proteins, Michaelis's book on oxidation reduction. All of this was in the air at the time. And a large part of it, I think, had come out of more the German philosophical schools and the trend in German biochemistry at that time, because American biochemistry was largely in the medical schools and was devoted, as I'm sure you're well aware, to simply improving clinical methods. I had no interest in that whatsoever. That's why I didn't go to medical school. Large clinical chemistry in the United States at that time was improving methods of urine and feces analysis. And very important. I'm not saying it's unimportant. It's still very important today. But it was not what I wanted to do. And here was Sailing Hecht, and the air was in the campus. It was well known that here was a man who was trying to understand sensory physiology by applying physics and chemistry as to how light impinged on the retina, how it stimulated nerve fibers, and so on. And in my senior year, I actually sat in on a few of his lectures. I took the course, which was open to both seniors and first-year graduate students, as a first-year graduate student. And that made up my mind. At the same time, I was taking the advanced course in genetics and other things as well, and I was serving for 16 hours a week as a teaching assistant in biology. And the second year I was a teaching assistant, my assignment was to improve all of the first semester experiments for the beginning student, since I was now the chemist in the department. So a friend of mine and myself, who were the he was the senior teaching assistant, we introduced into that experiments, very simple enzyme experiments. So the student could see in a beginning biology class how an enzyme worked, and you could do some of the things about denaturation, boiling it to kill the activity, and measuring rates and that sort of thing. In a very simple, very primitive way, but it was quite successful.
I had also forgotten to ask you about a mathematics background, if you had much of a mathematics background.
I didn't have a mathematics background. It was only after I realized that I was going to go into a field like biophysics and general physiology, or even more advanced chemistry, that I didn't have the mathematics background. I had been poorly advised. Pre-medical students were not advised to take much mathematics beyond advanced algebra. So I caught up, and I finally took, before I got my undergraduate degree, analytical geometry. And I never took a course in calculus. I bought two good books. One was the standard Osgood calculus, which I suppose everybody used at that generation. And on the advice of someone, I'm not sure who it was, I bought a book called Mathematics, Higher Mathematics for Students of Chemistry and Physics, by a great Australian named Mellor, who later edited a huge treatise on inorganic chemistry.
Oh, yeah, right? Sure.
That's the Mellor.
Yes.
Who wrote this book. And I found that the combination of the two was just wonderful, because what Mellor did was to take very simple things in chemistry and physics and show how you apply calculus to them. So I learned, I was taking thermodynamics at the same time, by the way. And Harold Urey didn't want to let me in the course.
Really?
Because I hadn't had the year's course in calculus, which was a prerequisite. And I said, well, it's on my head. If I fail it, I fail it. But I think I can do it, because I have started, actually, some of the calculus during the summer. And I developed just enough interest in it and excitement to realize that this was a very, very powerful tool in understanding all of these things. And I had absolutely, I never worked as hard in my life, I must admit, doing the mathematics at the same time as doing the chemistry. But I found the principles of chemical thermodynamics so straightforward and simple and logical. In fact, my complaint was then, and it has since been rectified, that the rules of how chemistry works are not taught until you were a graduate student. Now it's back in the freshman year where it ought to be. Chemical reactivity is now taught in the freshman year. You know, Pauling's the nature of the chemical bond and all the things that go with it. We didn't have any of that. What we had in the freshman year was memorizing all the compounds of the inorganic periodic table, and it was a total bore. And I wasn't interested in the Frasch process or the Bessemer process. I wasn't going to smelt iron, and I wasn't going to mine sulfur or any of these other things. But that's what you had to memorize in the freshman year in chemistry. And that's what high school chemistry was, which I found dull as hell. There might be people who were attracted to it who wanted to be chemical engineers. And two of my high school friends who ended up at Columbia also did become chemical engineers. That was good for them, but not for me. Simply a different interest.
Did you have any other interactions with Yuri?
I got to know Yuri quite well over the years as his graduate student. Yuri was not the most inspiring teacher as a lecturer. He was too busy with his own things, had a tendency to come in unprepared, and sort of flounder around with the mathematics and give us a totally different derivation of the one that was in the book. The best teacher of physical chemistry at Columbia was Louis Hammett. And Louis was marvelous, because he was a real inspiration in a certain sense. Well, what we had from Louis, I took half of the thermodynamics from Hammett, and then I took Hammett's physical organic chemistry course, which later became his great book. And that was his joy, because again, one was learning what this was all about, in terms of not simply reactions that you carried out on paper, but what made them go, and what the rates were, and why it didn't go in another direction, and all that kind of thing. That I found very exciting. I saw Hammett the year I was elected to the National Academy. It was the last meeting he attended in Canada. Quite a pleasure. He even remembered me.
That's great. So you were attracted to Heck partly through your exposure to him as a senior, and then
as a first-year
graduate student. Can you tell me something about him and what that biophysics laboratory was like when you started working there?
Well, Selig Hecht is a product of the City College of New York, and took his PhD at Harvard in experimental biology with a man named George Howard Parker, who was one of the great pioneer zoologists in this country, of the type that tried to understand comparative physiology, what made things work, what made animals behave as they do, and this kind of thing. And Hecht started out in his laboratory doing essentially experimental biology, and was inspired also not just by Parker, but by Jacques Loeb's teachings and his books. And Hecht's early experiments were simply on photoreception in animals. He shined a light on an animal, it did something. It either went towards it or it went away from it. Well, this is the kind of thing that Loeb had been doing. But Hecht carried this a lot further in that he showed, for example, that from the time you shined a brief exposure, and I'll give you the classical case that he used with the long-necked clam of Cape Cod, Maya arenaria. There is a light-sensitive spot on that clam that had been identified long before. Now, if you shine this light on that spot, clam retracted. It tried to put its siphon back into the shell. What Hecht found is that you could use a very short exposure. You didn't have to shine the light continuously. And intensity times time was a constant. You need a certain amount of energy to get this thing to move. He found that that constant was independent of temperature, like all photochemical reactions. Now, we're talking back 1916, 1917, 1918, 1919, in that period. He also found that there was a latent period after you shine the light. That latent period was sensitive to temperature. That obviously had to do with the dark process. So he began to work out ideas in terms of the mechanism of the photoreception process. And he studied this in other animals, and then of course this got applied to the human eye as well. But here was the application of physical chemical thinking to try to understand a very complex biological process. And from his doctorate work, he went abroad. He worked with Bailey, who was a photochemist at Liverpool, to learn photochemistry. He worked at the zoological station in Naples because marine animals were available there, the kind that he wanted to study. And he learned how to extract rhodopsin, which other people had been studying much earlier, of course, goes back into the 1870s and 1880s. But the important point is that he could measure the sensitivity spectrum of the human eye in low intensities of light and show that it was essentially identical with the absorption spectrum of rhodopsin. That was the first proof that rhodopsin really is responsible for rod vision in the human eye. But this involves spectroscopy, monochromatic light, used for studying human vision, as well as studying the absorption spectrum of animal rhodopsin. This is the kind of thing that I found very exciting. But then I've told a story in my essay about how I did my doctorate thesis. Now, Hecht had the custom that everybody came into the lab would do at least one piece of research jointly with him, a short piece of research just to get the feeling of handling equipment, how you think about research, and how you do things. And I did that with a piece of research on intermittent stimulation by light for the human eye. And then I've told the story of how I got into photosynthesis, which was quite accidental. It was a very small and intimate laboratory group. Hecht had one full-time research assistant who was also working for his degree, and there were never more than four or five graduate students in the lab at the same time, and perhaps one postdoctoral fellow. So the lab was no more than six, seven, eight people maximum. And Hecht, having worked in England, had the custom that every day at 4 o'clock there was tea. And unless you were in the middle of an experiment or teaching at that hour, you were expected to come in for tea and conversation. And the conversation could sometimes go on until 8 o'clock in the evening, when Hecht had gone home long ago. But the arguments among the graduate students continued there and then in the cafeteria down the street and back in the lab at night and that kind of thing. It was a very intimate, excellent group of people.
You presented paper in Leningrad in 1935, which was the result of what, the very first work that you
That's
did
right.
with him?
That's right.
And it was also a belated honeymoon.
That's right.
That's what was it like going to Leningrad in 1935?
Well,
was that at Hecht's insistence or suggestion?
No. My wife and I thought we wanted to go to Europe. And there was no way we were going to go in 1934 when I was still very busy as a graduate student. She was teaching school. We had no children by plan. We were not going to have any children until we were settled somewhere and I had finished my graduate work. So we had saved a little money and we thought these international congresses were every 3 years. And the preceding Congress had been in Rome in 1932. And of course, you always know 3 years in advance. We sort of had that as a goal, that we would try to get to the next physiological Congress. Well, travel was pretty inexpensive at that time. It's, you know, inflation has hit travel as well. The round trip for both of us for that 9-week trip in Europe was $900. We traveled third class across the Atlantic, and we learned a trick from a friend of mine whose cousin ran a travel agency. The competition among the steamship companies was such that if you booked not from New York to Sherbrooke, but you booked from New York to Istanbul, they wouldn't book into the Soviet Union. They gave you a reduced fare, and they were responsible for all the train connections to get you to Istanbul, train or boat connections. And if you made sure to miss the boats, they'd even put you up at the hotels for a few days. And the same token, we booked a round trip back from Helsinki to New York. So the upshot of it was, booking through this cousin of a friend of ours, we had very inexpensive travel. And in effect, we had 3 days in Paris on the way, from Cherbourg to Paris, and then from Paris to Milan for a couple of days, and then we went to Naples because we wanted to visit the Zoologica, Stazione Zoologica, and we had 4 days in Florence. But the worldwide depression, I have still my diary. We paid $3 per person to stay in a pensione in Florence for 3 meals a day and a room each, $6 a day. Now the food was simple, you know, continental breakfast, coffee or tea and bread and rolls and jam. Lunch was very simple. You got a big soup and you got some kind of pasta or vegetables or something with it. Dinner, you got one, either chicken or meat or fish, something of that kind. Very wholesome food, very simple food, nothing fancy, but perfectly survivable. And every once in a while, if we didn't want to come back for lunch, we'd eat out somewhere, or we ate dinner out once in a while. And we stayed at this pensione had been recommended to us by Sailing Hecht. He and his wife had used it. We stayed at a pensione in Naples, which he has used at one time. These things went on from generation to generation, except that the war disrupted all of this, of course. What he had used 10 years or 15 years before, people had remembered. They were delighted to have us come on his recommendation. So we had planned to go to the, as an excuse to go to Europe, and the Physiological Congress was there, and Hector decided he didn't want to go to the Congress. He said, so why don't you present the work that I had done together with him and with Schleyer? And that was quite an interesting experience. We traveled third class through Russia. It was tough. We came in on a Russian boat, which was fun, to Odessa. The hotels were all right. But traveling on hard class railroad, we were young. We could do it. Lots of people have slept in YMCAs and hitchhiked across country. Leningrad was more luxurious, simply because we stayed in a fairly new hotel, and the government was putting up the whole Congress, of course, so they made a good show of this, and there were lots of banquets, lots of entertainment, and whatnot. But it was a very exciting first trip in Europe, and it was a very exciting Congress. Now, of course, there was no separate biochemistry Congress at that time. Biochemistry and physiology were part of the same affair. But my session was in sensory physiology. And I didn't know at the time, but I found out later, that Hecht had written to Adrian, who was going to be chairing that session, to look out for this young fellow, make sure he doesn't get into any trouble during the presentation. And I presented my paper, which I had rehearsed very carefully, because I had given lectures here, but that's a different thing before a big international audience. And first question was not a simple question, but a statement plus a question from Henri Pierron, a very distinguished French sensory physiologist who had also worked for many years in the field of vision. And then he was followed by Walter Trendelenburg from Berlin with a long, complicated question in German, and Adrian leaned over and says, you don't have to answer if you don't want to. And I said, I can answer both, thank you. Which I did, but in English. And it was very pleasing to be able to have survived the experience. And I must admit, the preceding afternoon, my wife had gone out with some friends swimming on one of the far islands, in the famous Stony Island, Kaminoi Ostrov, while I stayed home writing out my speech carefully and going over it again and polishing it. It was worth it. As a reminiscence, in 1975, you still have some?
No,
in 1975, I was back in Leningrad for the first time. 40 years later, at the 250th anniversary of the Soviet Academy of Sciences, or the Russian Academy of Sciences. And one evening, after some kind of entertainment, I've forgotten what it was, we ended up at the supper table with some old friends. And those old friends consisted of Severo Ochoa, now living in Spain, who had come from Spain to attend that Congress and whom I didn't know at the time, with Alexander Bronstein, who was also at that Congress, now deceased, one of the most distinguished Russian entomologists, and with Vladimir Engelhardt, now deceased also, was also at that Congress. So there were, and there were a couple of other people at this huge table, but there were four of us who were at that Congress, and of course Bronstein and Engelhardt knew each other, but the rest of us didn't. 40 years later.
That's amazing.
Only 40 years later I represented one of the people to represent our National Academy, which was a kind of an amusing homecoming 40 years later. My wife looked at each, and I looked at each other and said, would you have believed it 40 years earlier? The answer was no.
On this trip, were you cognizant of any political developments going on?
Oh yes, very much so. Because don't forget that Hitler had taken power in 1934. Europe was full of refugees. They were already piling into the United States, as well as all over Western Europe. There were a number of German refugees in the Soviet Union at that time, many of whom stayed, some of whom left subsequently. And there was a considerable amount of tension in the air. And Pavlov, the distinguished Russian physiologist, was the president of the Congress, and his opening speech was a plea for peace, in effect. Everybody was well aware of what was brewing, or what the potential for war was brewing. But certainly Germany never disguised any of its intentions, and the question was whether you took them seriously or you thought that this was all bluff. And certainly I took it seriously. And we avoided Germany by going back through Helsinki, Stockholm, Copenhagen, London. We did not go through Germany at that time, for obvious reasons.
Yeah. So you got your degree in 37.
Actually, my...
You finished the work in
36,
I think.
But Columbia had a firm rule. You didn't get your piece of paper until that thesis was published, which was not until 37.
So it had to be published, not just completed, but it had to be published.
It had to be published. It had to be published, and you had to turn in 75 reprints.